We're up to Hebrews chapter 11, verse by verse, chapter by chapter, paragraph by paragraph. Let me say, don't take that for granted. It might be normal practice here at North Mead and many other churches that you know of, but in Fiji, this is rare. It's almost unique. Our preaching there, it's sort of the preacher takes a verse and away they go, and then the next week or the next time we meet is a different verse and kind of away you go somewhere else. Our ministry, I want to say, is like the ministry that goes on here. That is, we seek to work through books of the Bible, and in fact this year we have been working through the book of Hebrews. The university term's a bit shorter. We only got up to chapter 8, so it's good for us and good for you, hopefully, to kind of finish off and kind of head towards the end as we are in chapter 11. I need to let you know that in another cross-cultural experience for you is I'll be using a different Bible to the one in front of you. It's a little Fijian Bible called the NIV. You might have heard of it, but if you want to follow what I'm saying, it's on the screen. But if you've got the Holman in front of you, that's fine. I'm sure you'll cope. Look with me, please, at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 11. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Now, at first glance, this does read to us like a definition of faith. So when it says, now faith is, we then expect what's to come as a definition, an explanation. And if that's true and right, then it does read a bit like that description Richard Dawkins gave us, like blind faith. That is, I can't see it, but I believe it anyway. Let me give you four examples of how Christians have taken faith to mean this. I hesitate to give you two from Fiji because they're kind of negative, but I'll balance that out with two from Australia that are just as bad. All right, so we had a preacher on one of our campuses. That's where Elise and Usa studied, not during their time, but a few years ago, where the speaker said that she went shopping by faith. And what she meant by that is she didn't take any money with her, no credit cards. She went by faith. And she walked around and picked up things, put them in a basket. And as she was queuing up, the person in front of her turned around. It was an old friend of hers. They blessed her with $50 at the end of the conversation. She had $50 worth of goods in her basket. She'd shopped by faith. And she encouraged our students that's what it meant to live by faith. Sort of unprepared, you just go. And you trust, you believe, you hope that the Lord will provide. One of our team, he went looked to go on mission by faith. So they didn't plan or organise their funds. They just turned up at the airport. They're meant to go to the US. And so they were waiting by faith for their tickets to come. You might have come across in Australia, as I have, a number of what are called faith-based missions or faith-based ministries. And as far as I can tell, what they mean is they don't plan or organise their finances. They just have faith that the money will turn up in the bank. Friends of ours, Australian friends, they sent their son to a private school by faith, meaning that they didn't have the money. But they just had faith that it would all come about and all work out. Is that what faith means? If it is, I want to raise two issues for us. The first is that that understanding of faith, it does fit with what Richard Dawkins says, that it's in spite of or with a lack of evidence. More significantly, though, for Christian people, what happens when it doesn't work? I know of somebody who went shopping by faith. They had their trolley full of goods. The checkout girl, she checked everything through. How do you want to pay for that, cash or credit? And the man said, I have no money. What happens then? I'll tell you what happens. They give you back all the goods. You put it back in your trolley and you've got to go around and restock the shelves. What happened to mission by faith? The team sat there waiting. They're waiting when the plane took off to America and they all picked up their luggage and went home. But more significantly, when that occurs to you, you start to doubt. You doubt yourself. You think, that happened because I didn't have enough faith. Maybe I don't have any faith. Maybe I'm not really a Christian. Or you doubt God. You say, I had faith, but God let me down. I did what he commanded, I did what he wanted, and he wasn't anywhere to be seen. I want to put it to you that is not the understanding of faith that we find here in Hebrews 11, 1 and 2. In fact, Hebrews 11, 1 and 2, it's not a definition of faith. So when we read faith is, we do instinctively think we're going to get a definition. So, for instance, happiness. Happiness is a mental or emotional state of well-being defined by positive or pleasant emotions ranging from contentment to intense joy. Happiness is, and then you get your definition. But we can also say happiness is in a different way. So like this cartoon. Happiness is an unexpected piece of chocolate. That might be true for you. It's true for me and my whole family, really. But it's not a definition of happiness, is it? It's like a practical, real-world, living example of what happiness looks like or what produces happiness. So too here, the author of Hebrews is not giving us a definition of faith, but practical, real-world examples that we can kind of see and grab onto and hear about. So in Hebrews, just as everywhere else in the Bible, faith means trust. It's also the same word for belief. It's trust. You trust in the trustworthy. You have faith in the faithful. It's a relational term because every relationship you and I have is based on trust to some degree or another. How much can you trust this person? Be it your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your spouse, your business partner, whoever it is, it's based on trust. And so here in the scriptures, we're called to trust in God, who is trustworthy. He makes promises and then he keeps them all. He's worthy of our trust. In my family, we have a little phrase I've said we're going to do something and the kids aren't sure. Oh, Dad, are we really going to happen? When are you going to do it? I'd say, what does Tony do? Tony makes it happen. I don't normally talk about myself in the third person, but I then get them to say it, so that kind of works a bit better. All right, but what I'm trying to say to them is, I'm going to do it. I've made a promise, or I've said it's going to happen, and I make it happen. That's my job as husband and father. I need to stick to my word. I want them to trust me. All the more with God. He makes promises, and he fulfills them. Sometimes I can't keep my word. I just lack the ability, or whatever it might be. Something's out of my control. Not so with God. He is sovereign. He always keeps his promise. And in verse 3, we see that is not blind faith that's being discussed. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. It's not blind faith, is it? See, that the word is understanding. That is the word for thinking, for using your mind, for reason and rationality. You observe, you consider, you listen, you hear, you weigh, and then you understand. And what your understanding is based on, what is the best explanation for the things you can see? Now that's how science works, isn't it? A scientist observes the observable universe, either at the large scale or the small, and then they come up with a theory, an explanation that is unseen for what is seen. And the stronger the theory, kind of the better it is, right? If it's got more explanatory power, it kind of works out and wins the day. So, for instance, Stephen Hawking, probably the most famous living scientist, certainly quite possibly one of the smartest, he says, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself. The law of gravity, there's no actual law that you can, it's not sort of written in the stars about gravity. No, that's what he's saying is our understanding. We look at the universe and we see how it works and the bodies move, and we've got a description of that and we call that gravity. And that it works all the time, our explanation, we call it a law. Kind of so strong is it, so almost irrefutable is it. That's just what the scriptures are saying. We understand. Well, we understand differently to Hawking, don't we? He doesn't consider God to stand behind our creation. He says the universe creates itself because the law of gravity exists. That's kind of how the law of gravity works. Now, is that a reasonable explanation? Certainly Hawking and Dawkins, they consider it so. Other scientists smarter than me that I've read, they would say, unfortunately, Hawking at this point, he confuses cause and effect. That is, the universe and everything in it, including the law of gravity, is the effect. But he wants to say this: the law of gravity must have existed beforehand to kind of create itself. It doesn't really work. It's like trying to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. In theory, it works, but in practice, it never does. But what Hawking and Dawkins and their like are saying is that the universe, it's all about what you can see and measure. And it's all the result of accident and chaos. There is no meaning or significance to this life, to this world, this universe. It's just stuff that happens. Gravity makes it this way. I'm going to suggest to you that neither Hawking nor Dawkins nor none of those guys, they actually live out what they think. That is, if the universe is chaos and accident, then there is no meaning. There is so no significance to your life. And yet both these men, they argue and work hard to persuade you of their view, don't they? They've invested a lifetime and so much energy in trying to get you to see things their way. But who cares? If it's all chaos, it's all meaningless, it's all insignificant, we're all going to be dead in 100 years. Who cares? And they come home and they kiss their loved ones and give them a hug. But there can be no such thing as love if the universe is chaos and random. It's just chemicals in your brain and atoms firing off one another. See, their theory, their explanation, it lacks the power for them to live it. You might call that hypocrisy. It's different for the Christian, though, isn't it? The Christian reads verse 3 in chapter 11. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. So we can look at the universe and say it is orderly, it is reasonable, it is rational in many ways. We can use our reason to understand it. We know that there was a beginning, and so it's perfectly reasonable to assume that before there was a beginning, there was something else. Then, in fact, there was a creator, a cause to the effect that is the universe. It's entirely reasonable to think that way, that one who stands outside this universe and was involved in its creation. And the creation bears the thumbprints, the fingerprints of the maker. That is, why is the universe orderly and reasonable and rational? Because God himself is that way, orderly, reasonable, rational. Why do we look for meaning and significance? Because there is a God who stands behind this universe and gives it meaning and significance. Why do we all long for and yearn for relationship? It points to a God of relationship. And if you've been here since the beginning of this sermon series, isn't that how chapter 1 of Hebrews describes God? That he's a God who speaks to his creation. And that by his word, yes, he creates everything, but also he draws us into relationship with him. And in being drawn into a relationship, you are changed and shaped. As you come to know that other person, you respond and react. And if that person is in fact the God of the universe, then we will submit to him. It will change us and shape us to live how he would have us live. For he's the creator who is good and knows how we are to live. And so there is a moral structure to the universe and how we are to live and to respond to it. This, for the Christian, or for anyone really, it's entirely reasonable because of our understanding of God and his work. And in this, he's worthy of our trust, our faith. I'm not claiming that Christianity is sort of perfect or there are no criticisms to be levelled against it or things we do need to wrestle with things. But this claim that our faith is blind or unreasonable is not one of them. And once you come to understand the reasonable nature of this faith, once you come to understand the God who stands behind it, it does though then lead you to live in what can be described as an unreasonable way. That is the basis, the grounds that reasonable faith is for the way the Old Testament saints and we too are called to live. Now, I went online a little while ago to see what other preachers do with this chapter. When I was told I was preaching on chapter 11, I went to one of my favourite preachers. He has got 13 sermons on chapter 11 alone. What does that tell you? It tells you there's lots of material there, and it tells you I can't cover it all tonight. So if I skip over your favorite character here, I'm not sorry about that. That's just what's happening. If you don't like that, you can take your complaints to Mike. I mean, not your complaints, your feedback to Mike, and talk to him about having a 13-week series on Hebrews 11 next year. I'm just going to pick on one character, that of Abraham. Let me read to you verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. God speaks, Abraham hears, trusts, obeys. From one perspective, the perspective of the world, for those who don't know what God that God has spoken, it looks ridiculous, doesn't it? It looks ludicrous. It looks unreasonable. See, Abraham acts at great personal cost to himself. He leaves behind land. He leaves behind family. He leaves behind his inheritance and sets off into the wilderness. Sociologists who like to study these sorts of things, they rate the nations and they rate Australia as one of, if not the most individualistic society in the world. That is, I'm an individual, I do what I want. So when you hear about people leaving and moving, yeah, good on you. You want to go to London to live for a year? Off you go. You want a gap year? Off your head. You want to move house? Up to you. Off you go. The same sociologists, they will say that Fiji is one of the most community and communal orientated societies in the whole world. That is, the ties of family, kin, relationship, bind them tightly. And the responsibilities that come with that. I want to put it to you that Abraham, he's more Fijian than he is Australian. Now, this was hard for him to leave. There was great uncertainty and risk. And Abraham spends his life rootless and wandering. To the world, he is foolish and blind. But from Abraham's perspective, from God's perspective, God has made him promises. And he's trusted them. He's trusted God. And that's the case for all the saints here. Verse 13 to 16. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. Skipping down a bit. They were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Abel, Enoch, Abraham, Sarah. They do not see the promises of God fulfilled in their life. We're told here in Hebrews, quite amazingly, that Abraham, even if he'd lived longer, even if he'd lived through the days of Joseph and going down into Egypt, if he'd lived through the days of Moses and leaving Egypt, if he lived to the time of Joshua entering into Israel, he still would not have seen the promises fulfilled. Because God's promises are not for this life, this earth, this age. They are for the next age, the life to come. We, as all people of faith, those who trust in God, we, if we call ourselves Christians, that is true of us. It's about the age to come more than it is about this age and this life. I was listening to another preacher. He said for many years he did try and write a sermon series on chapter 11. And he always wanted to call it Living by Faith. And he said it never quite worked. It never fitted. The different stories didn't quite fit under that heading. He said it took him many years to realize that the reason it never fit is because the chapter is not about living by faith. It's about dying by faith. What's on view in chapter 11 is the end, the finishing, how you finish, not how you begin. It was great to hear Shimon and Elise's story before. I hope you too have begun the Christian life to trust in Jesus as your Lord and Saviour. Beginning is great. You need to begin. And for some of you, you've been continuing in Christ, maybe for many years. But for all of us, we need to finish. See, anyone can start a marathon. But the key thing about a marathon is finishing. And that's what Hebrews 11 is there to encourage us to do, to finish the race, to not live in the faith so much as die in the faith. Now, to others, that's going to seem entirely unreasonable. I want us to think for a moment about our home, our city, Sydney. Sydney is beautiful. It's alluring. It's captivating. It's attractive. It's charming. It's seductive. This year with the team here, we were taken out on Thursday out into Sydney. Because you can't come all this way from Fiji and not see the sights. We did the same thing a few years ago. We're in a different part of Sydney, so we came by train over the Harbour Bridge. We went up a tall building. Down below us, there's the Harbour Bridge. There's the Opera House. We walked around the Opera House. We had a lovely meal together. We hopped on a ferry and went to Manly and ate ice creams at the beach. We then came back on the ferry. It was a day like this, beautiful, sunny. The Opera House on one side, Harbour Bridge in front of you, the sea glistening like a jewel. One of the students, she turned to me, who was standing there on the ferry, and the wind in your face and the sea breeze and the salt air, and she said, "I want to live in heaven. But Sydney comes a close second." That's true, isn't it? It's right. My dad was born in England. He says, Sydney is the best place. Sydneysiders, we know how good it is. And so we work so hard to get here and stay here. To live in Sydney, you need a big mortgage, don't you? To get a big mortgage, you need a good job. A job you work hard at. Chances are you need two of you to pull it off. So you've got to get married, and both of you need to have jobs to pay off your mortgage. And it's going to take you a long time. You've got to keep working at it. Day in, day out. Week in, week out. Year in, year out. And over the years, you'll probably pick up a couple of kids along the way. You have those. And then part of living in Sydney, you've got to kind of keep up with your neighbours. So you'll need, the big car to fit all your kids in, and they'll need to go to the best school you can afford. And that means a bit more money. And so you've got to get a better job. You've got to get that promotion. And you've got to work hard. And one day you'll pay it all off. But instead of being able to stop worrying and stop working, you're so old that you've had kids and they've grown up and they've got their own kids. And how are they going to get a foothold in the Sydney property market? So what you've got to do is you've got to babysit the grandkids so your kids can go off and work at two jobs so they can repeat it all over again. You're on the treadmill. You're in the rat race. See, Sydney seduces us. She promises much. Wealth. My father-in-law says to me, property prices in Sydney never go down. So get in the market while you can. And with that comes a promise of security, of status. You live in Sydney and thank God you don't live in Melbourne or Brisbane. You have significance. You've made it. You've hacked it. You've done it. There's pleasure. You can leave a legacy. You can leave your kids the house. But Sydney is a tough, cruel mistress. Christians, we should know differently to this. To everyone around us, we alone have God's perspective. Not a difference of opinion, but the perspective that includes not only this life, but the life to come as well. See, Sydney is just like a scratch lottery. You know those tickets you spend, $5, $10, $15, whatever it is, and you get it and you scratch off one symbol and you scratch off another symbol, and for 3 seconds you've made it. This is it. I'm going to be rich, $100,000, whatever it is. It's fantastic. My life's going to change. 3 seconds later, you've scratched off all the stuff, no matching symbols, waste of time, waste of money. So you just need the perspective of time to see how things really are. God's word, God reveals to us his time. His perspective, that this life is just a brief instant and the life to come lasts into eternity. Jim Elliot was a young man who set his heart on mission. He went out to speak to a South American tribe called the Orca Indians. And when he left his young wife and family behind. They were going to follow after he'd sort of established himself there. His boat pulled up. He hopped off the boat and he was speared to death on the beach by the Indians he went to evangelize before he'd even uttered a word. And this is what he said before he left. "A man is no fool to give up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." And he's right, isn't he? He had God's perspective. So you can't hang on to Sydney. You can't hang on to your house. You can't even hang on to your grandkids. It's all going to go one day, but the life to come will remain. The problem for us is, it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to live this way. We're on the treadmill, and it's hard. It's hard to give your money away to gospel causes rather than spending it on yourself. Our ministry back in Fiji, it struggles financially. Your church, we had notices this morning, your church is behind budget. It's struggling financially. Why? Because it's hard to give. If it was easy to give, we'd be flush with cash and so would you. It's hard. It's hard to give up your time to come here on a Sunday night. Good on you for being here. But you know that the beach beckons and there's the moonlight cinema and there's other things to do, and yet it's hard to come. I'm sure there's some of your friends who aren't here tonight. It's hard to give up time. Or harder during the week to get up early on a Sunday morning to come and serve in Sprouts or the other kids' ministry. It's hard to give up time during the week to go to Bible study. It's hard. It's hard to admit that you're a Christian at school or at uni or in the office. It's hard to seek to share Christ and to speak of him in what might be a very hostile environment. It's hard to do the right thing at work, to be honest and to stand up to your boss, or if you are the boss, to look after those under your care, your workers, to do the right thing by them, not to steal the glory, but to give them the glory. It's hard. What would change us? What would shape us? What would help us? Surely it's knowing Jesus. Surely it's not finding Jesus more beautiful, more attractive, more alluring, more captivating than Sydney is. And hasn't the book of Hebrews been showing you that week after week? Doesn't it seek to paint a glorious picture of Jesus, that he is greater than everything else? See, Jesus makes great promises of real significance, of a status where you are the Son of God. Does he promise you a true and final home? He offers you everlasting security. And if you're in any doubt, he seals his promises, he seals his covenant with his very blood. He had the treasures of heaven and he poured them out for you and me. He gave up his life for each one of us. See, Sydney, it will let you down, chew you up, spit you out. It will use you, but not Jesus. He doesn't use you, he serves you. He is the high priest. He is the one true sacrifice. He is the one true tabernacle, temple, where you can go and encounter God. He gives us access to a heavenly Father. He brings us into relationship with him, a true, deep, abiding relationship. See, Jesus, he needs to capture your heart, your mind, your soul. Then you'll pour those things out. You will be a stranger and an alien if you know Jesus that way. And only then, as you grab onto Jesus, will you be able to let Sydney go. You know, like a baby with its blanket. If you've got to get rid of that blanket, you've got to give it something else to grab onto. We need to grab onto Jesus. Or really, he kind of needs to grab onto us. And then we grab onto him. If you're young, as many of you are, you probably think about the mark that you will leave on this world. If you're older, you might think about the legacy you'll leave behind. We might be somewhere in the middle. I want to draw our attention to one more figure here in Hebrews 11. He's somebody most of you will be familiar with. His name's Joseph. You know, he had the Technicolor dream coat. His brothers betrayed him, threw him in a pit, sold him into slavery. He was sort of molested by Potiphar's wife when working as a slave, thrown into a dungeon after being unjustly accused. He dreamed some dreams, he interpreted some dreams, he's released from jail. He rose to prominence in the nation of Egypt. He saved thousands of people with his programs and systems. He was reunited with his family and they came to settle in Egypt. He's lived an impressive life and Hebrews recognizes none of it. It's not interested in his life. It's interested in his death. By faith, in verse 22, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. And if you're like me, the first time you read this, you think, what's it talking about? What instructions about his bones? I don't remember any of that. Let me refresh your memory or tell you for the first time. At his deathbed, he gathers his sons together, his two sons, and he says, when I die, the process of sort of mummification means his bones will be left and the flesh will be gone. He said, don't leave my bones in Egypt. But when God fulfills his promise, because he knew that God would, when he takes our people out of Egypt, take my bones with you. And if you read the story of the Exodus, when Moses leaves and the people of God leave Egypt, they remember this promise and they take the bones of Joseph with them. And if you read about their coming into the land under Joshua, they take the bones of Joseph in. His legacy was not the grand projects he did, but he reminded his family that his home was not Egypt. And the amazing thing Hebrews tells us is that the land of Israel was not his home either. He was looking forward to a heavenly home. That was his real home beyond this life. His bones were just a symbol of where his heart was. See, if home is where the heart is, and when my kids ask me where is heaven, I say it's where Jesus is, then let me say to you, set your heart on Jesus. Set your heart on heaven. Long for that home, our true home, in and with Christ. Let go of Sydney and all that it promises and offers, and grab hold of Jesus as he grabs hold of you.